Mayor Bourbeau was touching on the ceiling height requirement. Not a single zone should have a minimum of more than 12 feet. Commercial in any zone functions fine with lower ceilings. Look at Leber's Pizza. They're one of the most successful businesses in downtown with low ceiling heights. Tent City, there's countless examples. Ceiling heights does not dictate a business's success or failure. Likewise, 45 feet is what I'm asking and requesting for all mixed-use zones for building heights. 35 feet limits it to three stories, as council members alluded to. State law already allows four stories, so you may as well just make it 45 feet. And then remove setbacks entirely in all the zones, namely in the mixed-use zones. Setbacks are an archaic concept from subdivisions in the 1980s. There should be no minimums. If anything, do maximums. Many of the zones talked about just accommodating street trees, which is perfectly reasonable. And that's kind of across the board in all of them. It's interesting on the map, San Paolo was almost purely resident, or it was purely commercial, yet as it is today is really almost purely residential. So some of those maps were misleading. And I think the different options as far as how you allow the mixed use to proceed, I think, you know, in those zones along El Camino that you're talking about, the three different options of requiring it on the whole ground floor versus just the corner. Spring Street in Paso is a perfect example. They went with as loose regulations as you could go along Spring Street. They haven't had much redevelopment anyway. And that, why I say that is because it's really important you take off these guardrails and allow people as much flexibility as possible. Don't require commercial on the corner. Don't require commercial in general. Those areas are where we need residential. We need the residential people in those areas to support our commercial nodes. We don't want any spaces in those areas that are going to pull people from our commercial nodes. So we just want residential density in those areas. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Good evening, Jeff Hosselin. Most part, I agree with Mr. Zappas. I will talk in general without naming the other, but setbacks should be equal. Commercial should be zero. That's what it's required now. Why are we changing it? I think you have to look at something like El Camino Real. It used to be a highway. Look at the setbacks, look at what we just did in the downtown. When we talk about that, I call that the entertainment zone because that's been changed rather than just the downtown area. I think that definitely gives you an area of what you're talking about in the downtown. But elsewhere, you know, commercial needs to be, the setbacks are crazy. I also think parking in the rear hurts business. If you can't see the business being vibrant from the front, or you can't run in and grab something and go, you're killing business. So I have that. And then the other one on here is some of the comments and some of the things that we showed were San Luis Obispo. And when I go down Foothill Road now, it sucks. It's all shaded, it's tall buildings. It changed the total part of that city and what it used to look like. Those businesses are struggling, absolutely struggling. I know it's a different city. You have a college that is, the city's forced people to be on campus now, so it's changed the dynamics, but it's also changed the residency when you look at a lot of these areas in the city. It's not necessarily lowering the price of housing. It's not necessarily giving you workforce housing. And if I was to take a piece of property and want to just rebuild what I have, I'm questioning, can you do that now? Or do you have to put commercial and then residential up top? I think we have to look at things a little differently, and I think we're getting a little bit too outside of what the city of Atascadero should look like when we build out. That's my comments to that, and I'll look forward to the next meeting. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, bringing it back, I would note that under MU4, though, the staff has specifically suggested that there is no minimum or maximum setbacks on the front, except as needed to require street trees. So I was going to say I agree with Mr. Zappa's comment on that, but as it pertains to MU4, we're not requiring a setback. So I think that's addressed. And we are requiring a side and rear. And I certainly, especially if the rear backs up to residential, and I think that is important because I think people have, if you live in a residential place and you previously had commercial zone next to you, you shouldn't have to wake up to a three-story, building 5 feet from your fence. So, okay. Do we want to provide any other guidance regarding MU4 to staff?
We have a couple of discussion items if you wanted to get into that. We had some items and I need to put up on the screen for you that were some specific
guidance on. Yes, go ahead.
Questions.
But if you have a question, Councilmember Newsom, go ahead.
I had a question on the setbacks. There's no maximum or minimum on the front. What if it's a corner lot? Does that fall underneath side and rear, or don't corner lots have a totally different setback setting or requirement?
In this particular zone, there's no actual setback, so they have the same street tree requirement if they're on a corner or if they're mid-block. It's all based on the width of that building in sight.
So is the setback on the both sides considered front, or is it considered a side?
So yes, if you're on a corner, you have two frontage.
Oh, okay. Sure. So on a corner lot, there's no setback on either side. So on some of the parcels that are listed that were corners, ECR is no setback, and then the side street that it's running on it has no setback.
Correct.
Okay. And then on the height limit, we talked about the 35 feet. How does that affect fire response if the state law is 45 feet? Does that change our ability to provide public safety?
It doesn't change the height limit from what's there today. Okay. And so it's the same now, and it doesn't change our ability to fight emergencies.
With ladder trucks and such. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, any other, let's go to these discussion points and maybe we'll address what our concerns are and then see if we need to provide any additional guidance to staff. So the first question being, are the parcels identified for MU4 appropriate for this thing? I know Council. Yeah, look, throw it up on the map. We do have it on page 50 as well. Essentially, it's the ones next to curb rail we've been looking at, the ones near the outlets. I assume that goes south to about Bay Laurel, to the vacant lot north of Bay Laurel Nursery. And then but also the property at Del Rio that's already under development, is really affected because it's being built under a specific plan. Okay, so anybody have any concerns about the parcels included?
I do, with the exception, the question that move M1 to M4. Do you want to have that now, or you want to have it on M1?
Well, let's talk in M1. When we talk about M1, if you have some desire to think that something needs to be moved into M4. But
well, they want us to give them guidance on whether or not we're going to move the M1 parcels into 4. Okay. So we might as well do overlay to see if...
Well, I don't know. I think that we might have some substantial discussion about M1 as well, right? And then we say, let's put M1 with M4.
So we'll consider potential parcels as we go through 1, 2, and 4. Got it.
Okay.
I'm comfortable with M4 for everything between El Camino and the freeway. I'm comfortable for to Del Rio Road. If members are concerned about the properties on at Kerberil east of El Camino, I certainly could discuss that. But I think that certainly the rest of it is I'm comfortable with. I'm not opposed to this in those areas. I just recognize that's got a little different character of what's back behind it and how it sits in the land and could discuss it if somebody wants to.
Okay. Because the only one of these that backs up to parking would be, I mean, to housing currently would be the ones that you mentioned on the east side of El Camino Real. There is housing behind Walgreens.
Right.
And
yeah. And housing, but rising. And housing on the other yeah. side of Del Rio Marketplace too, as we
right. But I mean, you know, Del Rio Marketplace is already going up, and it's,
you know, that's a done deal.
Prove that as a special, you know, yeah. or a specific plan. So, okay. So I think we're good. The next question: are the setbacks appropriate? Should there be a certain percentage of frontage where buildings are required to avoid parking only along the frontage? I don't understand that question.
So the question is, and maybe in context is best, like for Del Rio Marketplace, there's retail one that's under construction that's kind of more along the frontage, and then there's some parking, and then there's two building plans right along the frontage at the corner, and then there's some along Del Rio. So should it be allowed to be only a parking lot with commercial uses towards the rear of the site with vertical mixed use on top of that? Or should some buildings be pushed forward, like where Cowgirl Cafe is and that shopping center, that building is pushed more forward. A lot of buildings are pushed back. Should there be some building along the frontage, or do we not care and it could be all parking?
I mean, for me, I don't know that you want to get that specific. I mean, you're saying at Del Rio, we're allowed essentially a large frontal exposure of parking. Are you suggesting?
Yes, they have four buildings pushed closer to the frontage.
Right, there. But not on the corner itself.
They do. Mm-hmm.
There's one more coming.
There's three more coming
okay,
along.
Three
yeah.
More. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I think it looks nice to have more out front, but I don't know that I would be in the business of dictating that. I don't know how my colleagues feel about that.
I don't want to be restrictive in terms of how we want the buildings to look from the road. If someone's developing it and they decide they want to put their parking in the front, I don't see why. Well, you know, there might be a mix of people that want to do building front, parking in the back. You know, I don't think I want to get restrictive as to where developers should put the parking lot based on how it's going to look. It won't make that much of a bearing, in my opinion, and I think it's just adding more unnecessary restriction.
Yeah, I think you can address that through, you know, you can't have just a blank, barren parking lot. If you're going to have it out front, you're going to have extra trees or extra vegetation. So the view as people approach it isn't, you know, like in the old days, it was just black asphalt. Yeah. You know, you go to a store or a big store in a lot of communities, and it was just black asphalt, no zero vegetation, et cetera. That's not what we'd allow.
One more comment. Mm-hmm. Especially in like near El Camino Real, in the busier areas in the middle of town, you know, between Cubaril or around Cubaril, having parking lots behind buildings can often be unsafe compared to having parking in the front. You're leaving an establishment, people the road can see you. It just seems like it's a, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but it's sometimes, you know, they have employee parking in back. And if we're in a mixed use where we're actually going to allow some residences there where people are living there 24/7, that might be fine. And
sure,
again,
the property, the shape of the property should dictate where your parking lot goes.
Exactly.
Not where the city wants your parking lot to be.
Exactly. I agree totally with that concept or that sentiment, in the sense that every piece of property is different, you know, because of its size, its shape, how deep it is, whatever. And if we try to get, when we get to this level, we're starting to do a one size fits all thing. So that's
my
comment.
I think we need to be respectful of property owners.
Yeah. So council.
Right.
Yeah. I think this is a situation where we're letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. And we should just let people, given where these properties are and how they're configured, we should not place any requirement that there's a certain percentage of the frontage that's there. I do like the mayor's idea that, you know, it can't be just flat asphalt. You got to Now, if you're going to put parking up front, then you can accommodate something more in the, you know, we do have requirements for trees in parking spaces, and those should definitely be included for these properties, and should be examined for whether they needed to be more robust for parking that's right out front of the building. But we don't need to require this.
Okay, thank you. And Councilman Newsom, I think you agreed with what we said about giving them flexibility.
Yeah, I think that we need to let the property owners decide how they want to use their property.
Excellent. Okay,
so our guideline.
I think that's clear to staff on that. And then what types of uses may be allowed in the zone? Are hotel uses appropriate here? Medical offices appropriate? Any uses that are not appropriate? Well, as staff, you did outline what you envisioned and, you know, not allowing automotive uses in these in new construction, I guess. Does council want to add anything to that? I mean,
I would rather see the list of what we're allowing and possibly allowing before we go through. I would like to see what the draft or the proposed is, what's already there.
Okay.
I want to make sure that we're not singling out one industry or one business that already exists there without doing a little bit more detail of what we have.
Okay.
I think since we're doing things that are attentive, that are a mix of commercial and residential uses, we do have to be mindful of what creates a decent residential experience. In this kind of, you know, you're choosing residential, it's above commercial, you're choosing a livelier environment, there's going to be more noise. But we should, but maybe not, you know, a rock band recording studio in the middle of this. We should be attentive to toxicity and smells in this environment. And that would, you know, affect some types of automotive uses or other things, you know, auto body work, that kind of thing would probably not be appropriate here. You know, changing out somebody's tires is probably not a big deal. But smells and toxicity.
I think in general, we're saying, you know, we want to allow a wide variety of uses, but before we can say specifically, we'd kind of like a list of, because I hear Councilmember Peake say the same, agree with Councilmember Funk's comment or Councilmember Newsom's comments, so that we would, like to see why, like kind of see what it is we're saying yes to and or more to the point, what we'd be saying no to. In general, from my mind, you know, the city loves to have hotels. They're a huge revenue generator. I don't know that they'd be fit in any of these locations, but if somebody wants to build a hotel in one of these locations, I'm inclined to say yes. but I don't know how amenable these locations are to that. I think on the medical offices, though, we might be having more of a discussion on that, not tonight, but when we talk about, what is it, MU3? So, okay. All right.
Thank you. We will bring you a complete list in the future.
Okay.
But yeah, tonight, I think you've given us good feedback on that. All we wanted to hear from you is, hey, is there anything that's a definite no? But our intent was to have this zone very similar to the commercial retail zone today, where there's retail uses, there's restaurants, there's some light service uses. The only thing that we felt, just as you already expressed, is that there's certain land uses that just aren't going to work on the same property as someone living when you're doing significant body shop repair or heavy automotive. And
right.
And that could also be performance-based if it's, you know, within certain feet of a residence too. It doesn't have to be throughout the whole zone. So you can put in standards like that as well. And so we'll come back with
what we to come back with. I mean, I would say though that if I move into an apartment above a bar or a nightclub, I'm not going to complain about noise at midnight on Saturday night. And if I move in above a gym and they, you know, play pounding music for their extra, you know, their spin class or something, I shouldn't complain. And that's the nice thing about, like, you know, people have an opportunity knowing what they're moving into, especially in rental property. And do I want to live there or not? Versus the safety issue of, you know, I don't want to be above a dry cleaner where they're using all kinds of chemicals. That's where we go, okay, no, that's not compatible from a safety perspective, not a personal convenience perspective. Okay, all right, thank you. Should we move on to MU2 then? One, you want us to go, we're going to one next, son. Okay, got it.
We need a
Yeah, actually, it's 8:20. Let's take a break here. It's 8:19. Let's come back. No, and let's try to get started before 8:30.
Yeah, that actually.
Music is fine.
Exactly. That's what I do.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, that's a real problem for the fitness. Or once people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now they play loud. They have that. Now they've got. And people dropping heavy weights.
Yeah.
AM 1230 KPRL and 99.3 FM. Paso Robles, Atascadero, and Templeton.
Tonight's city council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230 KPRL.
After 1989, the Soviet Union began to crack apart like an iceberg into independent republics. The Cold War seemed to be over, but conflict, like power, abhors a vacuum. In 1990, a new conflict with global implications arose in the Middle East as Iraq invaded its oil-rich neighbor, Kuwait. Acting to protect its own economic interests in the area, the United States was quick to respond. When formal demands that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein abandon his occupation went unheeded, President George Bush promised an overwhelming show of military force. He delivered an official ultimatum on January 16, 1991, announcing that Operation Desert Storm had begun.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak. Ground forces are not engaged. This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor. Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed. Its people brutalized. 5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
Although the major radio and television networks had crews positioned in Baghdad, as well as throughout the Gulf region, CNN was the only network to secure a dedicated phone line into their Baghdad bureau. From their exclusive vantage point, CNN correspondents John Holliman, Bernard Shaw, and Peter Arnett managed to broadcast the sounds of the initial bombing barrage as it occurred. For the first time in history, America listened to a war at the moment it began.
We're going to Bernard Shaw in Baghdad.
This is, something is happening outside. Peter Arnett, join me here. Let's describe to our viewers what we're seeing. The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going off all over the sky. Peter?
Well, there's anti-aircraft gunfire going into the sky. We hear the sound of planes. They're coming over our hotel. However, we have not yet heard the sound of bombs landing, but there's tremendous lightning in the sky, lightning like a fix. Bernie?
I have a sense, Peter, that people are shooting towards the sky, and they are not aware or cannot see what they're shooting at. This is extraordinary.
Employing devastating air power, the United States pulverized Iraq with tens of thousands of bombs, while incurring relatively few casualties of its own. The air attacks severely weakened Iraqi troops, setting them up for a ground attack that would push them from Kuwait in just 100 hours. Broadcast on television, the aerial nighttime raids seemed lit with the strange phosphorescence of a video game. As in Vietnam before it, television demonstrated its ability to mold public opinion by either exposing or inoculating viewers to the true horrors of war. But this time, there was no tape delay. The world watched as the destruction occurred.
Tonight's city council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
Welcome to Heroes of the Air,
True stories of those who flew for America and earned the nation's supreme military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Heroes of the Air is brought to you by the Air Force Association, an independent nonprofit aerospace organization which promotes public understanding of the role aerospace power plays in our national defense. Your host for Heroes of the Air is Gene Pell.
Edward Vernon Rickenbacker was truly a remarkable man. A hero of war, an eminently successful businessman, an able diplomat, a generous philanthropist, and many other things in his decades of service to the United States and the world. He was, perhaps above all, a warrior, one who cheated death several times over, including one remarkable survival after 24 days on a raft in the Pacific Ocean. Captain Eddie, as he was affectionately known to tens of millions, was also the recipient of the nation's highest award for valor. Eddie Rickenbacker was one of the top race car drivers in America when World War I began. He wasted no time in signing up, soon found himself in France on the staff of General John Pershing, and then managed to get himself assigned to the Air Service. He had found his real love. He quickly proved his skills in the air were as great as they had been racing cars on the ground. And well before the autumn of 1918, he was designated America's Ace of Aces for the number of enemy planes he had downed. On September 24th, Rickenbacker was named commanding officer of the famed Hat in the Ring Squadron, the 94th. And early the next morning, he decided to celebrate by undertaking a one-man mission over German lines. As he wrote in his autobiography, "Over Verdun, I spotted them coming. Two LVG two-seater photographic planes escorted by five Fokkers flying protection. All seven went by underneath me, and I cut back the engine and dived on the last Fokker." That was his first victory of the morning. Before the engagement ended, Rickenbacker had brought down one of the two-seater aircraft as well, adding to a total of what would eventually reach 26 confirmed victories in the air over France during the war. But it was for that specific action on September 25th, 1918, that Rickenbacker received the Congressional Medal of Honor for his conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty. After the war, Rickenbacker founded his own automobile company, but could not escape the lure of flight, becoming one of the most prominent and effective executives in the aviation industry. Eddie Rickenbacker, truly a legend in his own time and an American hero of the air.
The Air Force Association is proud to bring you Heroes of the Air, dedicated to those who earned the nation's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Their service and sacrifice reflect an ideal that puts others and country above self. AFA salutes all men and women in the Air Force who so selflessly serve our country each day at home and around the globe. Heroes of the Air is produced by Pelcom Communications in association with Radio America.
Tonight's City Council meeting is in recess and will return in just a short time. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL.
Form of options. Okay. So in this first one, are the parcels identified appropriate? This would be a place, I guess, to discuss whether or not we think any of these MU1 area item or properties should be included in MU4 or some other place. So I'll start on my left here, Councilmember Peak.
Yeah, I think in general, these are identified appropriately for this zoning.
Okay. I would tend to agree because
I mean, I don't
all narrow properties compared to in MU4, they were kind of larger, deeper properties that have more possibilities.
Yeah. But the last thing is also because right now we have maybe one or two houses that are along these areas that are might still be residences. I don't know. A lot of them have converted to businesses themselves. I just think this makes sense for sure, especially horizontal.
Yeah. The only one I would wonder about is this includes the on the corner of San Jacinto and ECR, where the Gather Market and H&R Block, et cetera, is that property might be more like some of the MU4 properties. Would anybody agree with that?
Well, that's the one that's being proposed for it. And if you look behind San Jacinto Center, they have Paseo Oaks on the left, which is a super high. I mean, that's like 40 feet in the air, the top from that. And then behind the San Jacinto Center, you have Church of Christ. But even the homes are at elevation, probably another 40 or 50 feet above the center. So if you're on that street off of San Jacinto, you'd be looking down on the top of a 40-foot building. You wouldn't even be looking at the side of it. Help.
Understand. That's a high, steep hill there. And the people up on, is it Hermosilla or whatever, is the street above that?
Be blocking anybody's view.
Right. So, okay, so jumping ahead to the third item there is what you're pointing out, I think. Councilmember Funk.
Could you put up the map? As we're asking about what's appropriate for the zoning, just let's get look at that map again.
If you stick to that one that showed the existing uses, I don't know if that would be more helpful to you, or which one would you prefer? Your question.
Well, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure that we're talking about, that we're talking about the right properties, because it's a lot of properties that are small and aren't very deep, and so we really have to allow for this. So I think that that we're all right there. This with MU3, we're allowing 36 units, three stories. All of these are three stories. And all of them are basically the thing. What's different about these are the setback requirements and the first floor height requirements, right? And what else?
The vertical and MU1, the difference is vertical and horizontal mixed use is to be determined compared to MU4 is vertical only. Because that's my question that's coming next.
Yeah.
Is what is to be determined? How does that come into play? Is that something we're determining
okay.
now?
Yeah, that makes, well, these aren't deep properties. So you can't do commercial in front and residential behind because it's not, there are hardly any of these that are deep enough to do that, right? What are we thinking of in a horizontal mixed use in these types of properties?
So there are some that could lend themselves to horizontal mixed use. I think as a use permit, we saw 4515 El Camino come through, 4915, which was almost like the block style development. So it had commercial on the ground floor, and then it was a pretty sloped site, and it went back somewhat deep. And then the top two floors were residential, and the residential ended up touching, because of the slope, the rear of the property.
Right. So I get that. That's a vertical mixed use, and I get that on this property.
Yeah.
What I don't understand is how is a horizontal mixed use option being configured on these properties?
I think it could be. There are several deeper parcels. There are potential. Part of the discussion revolves around how much of a commercial component do you want to require? So if you require a very large commercial component, that takes away some of the feasibility of the horizontal mixed use. But for example, K-John's was one of our first horizontal mixed use projects that we did along the corridor. There's two residential units behind the K-John's building. And that was when the new general plan previous first came out, that was one of the first mixed use projects that we did. And that was able to be accommodated on that parcel. So there are some options. Again, mixed use is allowed in this zone and vertical mixed use is allowed in this zone. And what we're saying is if somebody came up with a configuration for horizontal mixed use, would that be allowed in this zone as well? And then the question that leads into that as a layered component is how much commercial does a parcel need?
Okay. So I'm good with allowing horizontal mixed use on these properties. As MU1 is being configured, I think that we've got a reasonable set of properties for this usage.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, K-John's is what came to my mind. It's deeper than you realize in the sense that you have the store out front, you have the residences in back.
Yeah.
I'm going to defer to Councilman Newsom, and I had a question after her.
The nice thing about K-John's, you don't know that it's there until you accidentally drive around back, so it's nicely concealed. After laying this diagram over M4 and knowing the difference of vertical and horizontal, I'd like to leave these parcels as they are in MU1 and allow the flexibility to the property owners to do either or.
Yeah, keep that slide up for a sec. Why do we show a vacant parcel just north of, isn't that vacant parcel actually the Smooth tiny house place?
Yeah, that's Grand Oaks. And so again, they use a specific data set to pull this, and it's not updated quite as quickly as our projects are being built because we're so popular.
While you have this map, we show the vacant lot at Pueblo at ECR. My understanding is that lot actually continues on and backs up to Sinaloa, but it doesn't show that way here.
So there's actually three underlying parcels, I believe, in that area. And so the parcel that creates the L shape that's under the single ownership was actually zoned multifamily that fronts Sinaloa.
Okay, it fronts Sinaloa. It doesn't, I mean, because the way this shows it, it's just only fronts El Camino.
Right. The one that's being proposed for the, or that is under the general plan mixed use designation, the L piece that goes back is a separate parcel, and that parcel is zoned multifamily under the general plan.
Okay. Got it. As long as I'm not mixing stuff up here, we're talking in this MU1, which is generally speaking is these smaller lots, mid-block, somewhat narrower. Why are we suggesting... Well, never mind. We're saying minimum setback front is just as needed to accommodate tree. Okay, maximum 15. And rear, none required. In other words, no rear setback required except transitions to adjacent single family. I mean, when we say none, do we mean literally you could build something onto the rear property line?
That's how our current setback standards read for commercial zoning districts.
So where there are houses backing up to these properties that we're showing here on the screen, you could build a building right up against to the neighbor's fence line?
You could. Construction-wise, it's a little bit hard. You're usually set back a couple feet, but you could. And so we're proposing that we enact our objective design standards that we've already put on mixed-use buildings and residential buildings and apply that to the commercial. Even if they did not include mixed use development, it would still be applied to commercial development. Okay.
Well, I like the except transitions to adjacent single family, because I mean, I don't think somebody's should have to have a, you know, even just a 15 foot tall commercial building that's right next, literally backs up to their backyard fence. Okay, got it. Let me see here. MU1, my MU1 questions. Okay. One of the questions I have is, in general, these are small lots, and could we, in, I'm assuming that we would like to encourage some lot mergers, so some different things might be able to fit on some of these things. So we could, as a matter of policy, have no fees for lot mergers, let's say, correct? Something like that.
Correct. We try and make those fees as small as possible anyways, because generally merging lots in Atascadero is a helpful process.
Right.
But we could subsidize them further.
Right. And I just say, we want this to happen, therefore we're not going to charge a fee for it because we want to see this happen. Okay, got it. Okay, that's that. Let's see. So, I mean, I got into setbacks. I didn't hear any other. Does anybody else want to comment on
that? I just want to comment on setbacks, and especially in the rear, because we have a lot. Like, if you look on, like, El Camino, where it parallels Palma, a lot of those residential lots on Palma, the houses are near Palma, and they're big lots that go, they go downhill, and then there's a fence, and then the building's right there. So we already have, like, some buildings that are uptight against, some commercial spaces that are uptight against the property line. But, you know, if the lot, the adjacent lot is big enough, a lot of the houses are going to be further away from it or on the other street, or even in the areas that are MU1 on the other end of town. The parallel road on the other side is multifamily, so a lot of those are condo associations, apartment buildings, or like quadplexes that are on Santa Isabel and on Sinaloa. Sinaloa, Santa Isabel. So I don't think that the setback, what it is now, is working just fine, in my opinion.
I do think there's a difference, though, between backing up to a street like Palma versus backing up to a residence that, you know, comes off of Santa Isabel. Because, I mean, if I live on Palma, I'm not, I mean, there's a street between me and whatever might get built there. But you're saying on Palma, you're talking the upper portion of Palma, the uphill portion that goes uphill from the artery?
No, even if you, no, yeah, Palma goes all the way to,
oh, all the way, Pinto. Gotcha, okay.
The left, the west side of Palma, those houses are generally, I mean, that's the main area of what we're talking about, gotcha. That whole stretch of El Camino.
Gotcha. Okay. Councilmember Fung?
Yeah, it. We're looking at minimum setbacks in the back when they're adjacent to single family. What about when they're adjacent to multifamily? Because don't we have some sections of that, particularly in the southern strip of the of land that we're talking about, that has multifamily back behind?
I believe most of it backs up to multifamily. So Palma is a multifamily district as well. Those, I think we are proposing, Genevieve can hop in if she's still there. I'm sure she is. I believe we are potentially proposing that those transition development standards be applied when it's not only adjacent to single family, but also multifamily.
That would make me more comfortable, because I don't think they're excessive transition standards. As I recall, it's like 5 feet or something. It's not huge.
Currently we have, so this is the ODS has a minimum 15 feet for four stories, or you could do an option to like do an upper story setback. So a 10 foot on the lower two stories and an extra 6 feet on the upper stories. So what we were thinking for mixed use is just to be really kind of clear and just say that there would be a 10-foot setback, which is a little bit less than the single family, just kind of paralleling some of the multifamily standards on the other side.
I can live with that.
I mean, I would prefer, you know, if you're backing up to residential, whether it's single family or multifamily, that I liked what you first said, which is, you know, like a 10 foot, but then more on the upper floors. So you're not facing a big wall.
We can bring back a proposal for that. I think the proposal was just to match the adjacent zoning district, which is just 10 feet. And we should keep in mind, too, that while they're developed a lot of single family and nobody's going to make them develop, they are zoned multifamily. And so you could put a 3 or 4 story multifamily building right there, 10 feet from your property line on a multifamily property. Not likely to occur in some of our areas because of topography and those kind of things, yeah. But in theory, you could.
But that's what's allowed on those current multifamily. In this case, we're talking about upzoning these commercial properties to mixed use to allow up to a 35-foot structure. So my deference goes to the people living on the backside of that, if you will.
Yes, yeah, and our commercial district already allows 35 feet, so the height's not changing, just that there might be residential on the upper floors.
Okay, I think the key, Councilman Newsom, any comment on that? Because move on.
I'd like to see your proposal when you bring it back.
Okay. I think the key thing here, if commercial appearance is important, would we support flexibility allowing those spaces to be incidental residential uses, and what types of uses should be allowed in this zone? I think this is really the critical consideration, because as I mentioned before, I think we all understand that every city in America, because of the Amazon effect, has surplus retail, commercial retail property that will never, there's no way all of it will ever become commercial retail. And so you need to allow some different uses, or it will never develop. And so the question is, what should we allow? And to any degree, should we allow residential without a commercial component in some of these things? And if so, where? But if not, what kind of commercial uses would we allow? And how much commercial would we want to require, if so? So I'm going to start the other end this time, Councilmember News.
I'm going to say that I don't think that we need to put a commercial requirement on every single one of these properties. I think we should let the property owners decide. I mean, our corridors are already mixed. So, you know, I think that whatever's viable, we talk about these being the smaller lots and being very hard to put commercial on that property and make it work. I mean, I don't want to put a requirement on that's going to devalue someone's property. So I think we need to be flexible.
I mean, except we're not devaluing in the sense that we currently require commercial. So if we're talking about changing to allow them residential, we're essentially...
Some of those properties are not in their final stage of use. So they have flexibility to develop on them. Mm-hmm. So what I don't want to do is come in and say, hey, I know you own that property. I'm going to go ahead and tell you, you have to put a commercial building on it. I'm not going to do that.
Well, except we already tell them that. Right. I mean, they're already zoned commercial. This is what we're talking about here.
If they merge lots, how does that work? Because you have some that are tied in with multiple lots, and you talked about conforming some of those parcels because they're corner properties.
So if you merge a lot and it's under two different zoning designations, the zoning designations stay even if the lot line goes away. So on that particular L parcel, it would go away.
So on these existing parcels that you have tagged, they're all zoned commercial?
Today, yes.
But not every one of them has a commercial building on it, correct?
Correct. I think when we talk about the corner parcels, like the one on Pueblo is currently vacant. Can you go back to the one?
So even the yellow ones that are currently residential single family are zoned commercial.
Doesn't one of them have correct. A vineyard on it?
Say that again?
Doesn't one of them have a vineyard or tree?
That's the one on Pueblo that is currently vacant.
Okay. Grapes.
Sorry.
Okay. I mean, I totally understand what you're saying. I think this is really probably the biggest single thing here, because if we say we'll allow residential on all of these things, I think they'll all be residential.
Yeah.
Because you build a house, you build apartments, you know, townhomes, there's a demand for them, right? They're going to get rented. They're going to get sold. And then we'd be hard pressed to say, well, yes, that one, no, that one, you know, yes, that one. But if we allow them on all of them, it will all be housing. And then I think you might have concerns about traffic in the sense of the number of driveways all entering, people making left turns out of their driveway on El Camino. I'm not sure how that kind of plays out, but I understand what you're saying of right now, property owners, like, you're telling me I can only build a commercial building on here and that's not viable. So what the hell am I going to do with it? So
I am. And you have residents that are coming forward saying, hey, I'm in this conundrum. I want to do something with my property. It's so restrictive. We can't. And then we have a bunch of empty commercial spaces on San Anselmo and, you know, even across the street in some of the complexes in Smart and Final and Food for Less, there's empty commercial. So if empty commercial is sitting, why are we going to impose more building of commercial? Utilize the property the best that the property owner can, and I think it benefits the city in two ways.
I think part of the problem we have with our with a lot of empty commercials, we've got a lot of suboptimal empty commercial, and so it's not renting out because there's an oversupply of kind of minimally attractive commercial properties from a variety of perspectives. I think we can make the commercial properties at our nodes more viable if we allow mid-block residential in these zones, and I favor that. And I think, and I don't think we should require commercial glazing on those properties. If we're going to allow mid-block residential on the first floor all the way up, that we shouldn't have to, those shouldn't have to be done special for convertibility.
Okay. I mean, I totally understand those sentiments, and but I mean, this is a major, the most major change we're talking about here. I just want to be clear about that. That essentially we're rezoning this entire mid-block strips of El Camino Real from commercial retail to residential. Or we're going to call it mixed use, but if we allow residential without requiring any commercial, essentially we're rezoning it residential, right?
Yeah, it could build out that way.
How does it affect you in terms of us renaming its place type?
It does not, because it is something that could be allowed within the parameters of mixed use zone, because commercial would still be allowed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there any aspect though in terms of, I'm curious about like I said, driveways. You look at all these lots, so is now every one of these lots, which I guess it would as a retail establishment anyway, have a driveway with left turns out onto El Camino Real. So that's already kind of in the cake. It's already baked in the cake because it's already currently set up that way as commercial lots.
Correct.
Okay, so that would not be an impact or an issue.
And it might be good to focus first on the key lots that are called out, which are the corners or the mid-block ones that are larger commercial centers. Is there a consensus that those should be something different, or just the corners should be something different? It can be either or a combination of two, and then we can talk about the ones that aren't those.
I don't think we should single them out. We haven't like reached out and done that public outreach, and existing council that has sat here has for years said, you have to do public outreach as we do these nodes. And that included notifying Smart and Final, Food for Less, everybody, if we make major changes. We've only heard from one of the residents of anybody that's in here. I don't want to be more restrictive, but if we allow additional uses, I think that gives them the ability to use their property a little bit more than they currently are utilizing it.
Well, I generally agree. I mean, we certainly don't ever want to take away something without making sure those people have been individually notified. We're talking about substantially upzoning the uses of property. And I think I can agree with you saying that we don't want to say yes to 80% of these and no to 20% without having discussion, other than maybe we want to say something about corner properties.
Yeah, so currently the way they're zoned, they would only allow vertical mixed use today. So calling them out as a mixed use four would be maintaining what they currently could do today. And so the discussion is, do we want to leave them as they're currently today and have more of that commercial focus, or should they be grouped in with the mixed use one zone, which depending on your consensus could be 100% residential, could have flexibility in multiple directions.
I'm sorry, we were talking about the corner property. You said mixed in with MU1. We're talking about MU1.
So the properties on the map, if Phil can go back to the map, the options were on the ones that are the darker purple color to zone those mixed use four, which is vertical mixed use only, because those are more viable commercial parcels.
I don't think that we tell them vertical or horizontal because they're the tiniest lots.
The only one I would think, though, is the one on the corner. What did you call the center?
San Jacinto Center.
That's a substantial corner lot. That's not like the rest of these in terms of being mid-block, commercial retail, small lots. That's the one that doesn't, fit like the others. But the others, I don't know. These special ones are. Did you highlight them because they're wider?
That's
they're
Adobe
larger?
Pueblo Adobe.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. That's Adobe.
The, and the other I don't know what they call the center. It's 7635 next to where it used to be the tribal TANF was next to it.
Got it. It's the old Dignity has it, Health has a thing there.
Yeah.
Got it. If we're going to make this change, though, I feel somewhat agreeable with Councilmember Newsom's, like we shouldn't be picking them out, except for that one on the corner there, because that's a very good sized property. So I don't know, Councilmember Funk, you have a comment?
Yeah, I'm confused. I was looking at allowing within the MU1 zone, allowing full residential in the mid-block sections. Does that mean that we need to designate anything that doesn't allow full mixed use? Does that mean that all of MU1 would need to allow residential on the ground floor, and we'd have to withdraw that designation and designate other things as other areas as to move some of it into some other category?
This is our first stab at doing that exactly. Yes, this map here before you is saying, hey, you could preserve some of these sites for the vertical only, or to have some commercial on them, or you could have them all MU1. But let me just back up a moment, because the reason we selected all of these properties was because a lot of these areas, you know, aren't the most significant commercial areas in the city. They're very watered down with random land uses. They're very underdeveloped. They're very underutilized. And they're part of Atascadero's 7-mile sprawl. How do you change that? How do we get away from that? We already have these huge viable properties like the Kmart Center and these other areas that have these huge opportunities for big commercial. So this was chosen to be, these are basically, how can you incentivize some kind of redevelopment to happen here as much as you can? But this particular slide here steps back and says, hey, if you wanted to still preserve some of these as MU4, you can select those, or you can select other ones. You can do whatever you like, or you can ask us to bring back some more information. But I think council's heading the right direction by saying, hey, let's have some flexibility here. Maybe some of these are all residential if they want to develop that way. And the reality is not all of them probably will, because there are a few token reliable or viable commercial uses in here that people want to continue those land uses, and they can. It's nice having the flexibility as we move forward.
Yeah. Well, I hesitate to go back and forth here, but you know, when I think of like Adobe Plaza, Plaza de Pueblo, those are fairly substantial size. They're maybe not all that deep, but they're, you know, a fairly wide expanse. So in that sense, they are different than a lot of the other little lots. Like I think next door, the little liquor store and Santa Lucia properties, a little more, much, much smaller ones, where commercial retail in the future is, you know, probably not viable. So, you know, if we included Plaza de Pueblo, Adobe Plaza in this and said, well, you can now build a whole bunch of housing here, from an investment perspective, would somebody go, well, hell yeah, I'll just tear the whole thing down and put maximum number of residential units on that? And, you know, would that be a loss of a viable kind of retail center? Or, I mean, those seem to fill up with tenants. They don't seem to have a ton of vacant spaces, at least not Adobe Plaza.
I think they're rotating on a regular basis tenants. I mean, we're losing tenants in that whole corridor in ECR. I mean, the turnover is huge. Almost every year, some of the businesses struggle in that corridor. So to keep putting commercial or forcing them into commercial, they're not sustaining the tenants. The turnover is huge on the Cabral